Mr. Alexander Forger, who is the chairman of the Milbank Tweed, Hadley & McCloy firm in New York City. He has been prominent in bar affairs over the years, serving as chairman of the Legal Aid Society of New York, serving in the House of Delegates of the City Bar Association on the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and other activities. Most recently, as a member of the commission appointed by the Chief Judge of the New York Court of Appeals to examine the question of mandatory pro bono service, a commission which filed its report, I believe, a few months ago, and is now the subject of further consideration in the New York Court of Appeals. After Mr. Forger, we'll hear from Jonathan Macy. Professor Macy is at the Cornell Law School, where he teaches a variety of business-related courses. He had a brief career at the University of Chicago Law School, and before that in practice, and having clerked for Judge Friendly in the Second Circuit. Mr. Forger.
Thank you, Judge. As I said earlier, I'm here for the comic relief after 2 days of active work for you. This subject, which initially had a different title, and as I was at the American Bar meeting last month, coincidentally listening to Vice President Quayle, I was reflecting on the title as it was then labeled, namely Regulating for the Public Good and In-Kind Transfers, wondering just what that meant, and I couldn't wait to hear what I would say on that subject. But then, as the Vice President, as you probably saw, made some commentary about the numbers of lawyers in the United States, and indeed suggested that 700,000 in this country, as compared to the relatively few in Japan, was an interesting commentary on the state of affairs here in the United States. It struck me at that time that perhaps that was for the public good, and in-kind transfer was sending perhaps 200,000 or 300,000 lawyers from the U.S. to Japan. Some would state, of course, that that really was for the public good. But in any event, that was not the subject that he sought to leave us with. Shortly thereafter, I listened to Justice O'Connor, and she delivered a very moving speech with respect to pro bono. She was the guest speaker at the Pro Bono Awards luncheon, and she gave us both good news and bad news. And the good news was that a lot of lawyers are spending a great deal more time in giving service, public interest service, and pro bono service. The bad news, she said, was the gap between need and service is ever growing. And it has reached a point today that she said was appalling, those in need of legal service and not receiving that service. I might add that she said, unfortunately, mandatory pro bono was a recipe for malpractice, was her comment. I had no time there for debate, so I'll have to save it for here. I started addressing this issue about 12 years ago when the so-called QTAC Commission was considering a revision of the model rules of professional responsibility. And indeed, at that time, the commission was advocating a mandatory pro bono. I then was president of the New York State Bar, and in our House of Delegates, put that proposition to our 125 delegates, and it was defeated by a vote of 123-2. It is in the annals of that bar, there has never been such a vociferous point of view so aggressively stated. We haven't come very far from that those days in terms of how the bar views that. And indeed, there are lot of movement in terms of the discussion of this issue in various formats and bar associations, including the one in New York. But I guess the only solace I can take about addressing the issue of mandatory and having some jurisdictions seriously consider it is that each time that happens, the amount of volunteerism rises dramatically. And it sustains itself perhaps for a year or two and then declines. But at least it has the good point of sensitizing more to the issue and getting people to think seriously about that issue. It is a, I suppose, an overall reason as to why would one seek to mandate that. Some would call it an oxymoron, but it really isn't charity or legislating morality. I think most would view it as simply discharging a responsibility that we as members of the bar have imposed upon ourselves and believe that we should implement. If indeed those of us who have spent our lives in law have a commitment to see that the legal profession functions well, and not only functions efficiently, but functions for the benefit of all of us. And as was said at lunch, if the rule of law doesn't perform, then we have dire consequences, I think, in our society. So I view it principally as a self-imposed obligation that we as lawyers have subscribed to when we take the oath as lawyers and recognize that there is a code of professional responsibility that would impose that upon us. When one addresses the issue of should it be mandated, the first question that generally arises is there really a need? And what is the nature of that need? And certainly numbers of states have had surveys in seeking to ascertain what is the extent of that need and the nature of that need. The ABA is about to undertake that nationally in the coming months. Each one of these, whether it's Texas, Massachusetts, New York, Maryland, has come back, whether it's scientifically true or not, but each one indicates that the needs that are being met are somewhere between 5 and 15, 16% as identified among poor people. The nature of those needs vary, but they fall into common patterns of housing, benefits, family, matrimonial. The principal issues that keep recurring in all those jurisdictions. But how compelling is that need? Most of the needs identified are pretty fundamental. Evictions, getting benefits, providing health care, and they are not the esoteric sort of class action, large, sophisticated, or philosophic issues, but very basic ones. The family matters frequently relate to battered spouses, the need for protective orders, concerns with neglected and abused children, the homelessness, at least as we have seen it in New York, homeless families, as distinct from the individuals, sets off a whole series of problems once the eviction occurs or the apartment is damaged by fire or water, leading to shelters and hotels and transferring children in schools and providing transportation. And the costs, as they have been assessed, are very significant. With one eviction or loss of one apartment, the city of New York can end up spending 10 to 20 times over the next 6 months what otherwise would have been expended in preserving that shelter or finding an adequate apartment of comparable dimensions. Those who agree that there is a need, and again, the focus here, let me backtrack one moment on the pro bono. in many of these dialogues, it is important to understand the definition of that term. And in different forums, it can have quite a different scope. The survey that Judge referred to, in which I was engaged, was in New York, seeking to determine how we can provide more legal service to indigents. That was its very narrow focus. It wasn't, should lawyers generally be giving a lot of time to public service, including charitable endeavors, educational institutions, and the like. It was restricted to providing legal service for poor people. The questions studied by that group, and indeed many others who have addressed it, is if you grant there is a need, and there can be debate as to is it, will it not clog the courts, and is it just generating more expense, and aren't some of these issues resolved in better ways? But to the extent one recognizes there is that gap, then how do you bridge it? And volunteerism certainly is the finest way, and that's the tradition of the profession. And I dare say virtually every lawyer has, at one time or another, given service, legal service, to the poor or to causes that help alleviate some of the problems of the poor. There are all sorts of innovative programs that our associations and others engage in the hopes of attracting individuals to donate some time and participate in those programs. Probably the most efficient way is the undertaking of law firms themselves to take on a case or cases or a particular representation. You can move people about, and there is no ambiguity as to whether an individual lawyer in a large firm setting has the freedom to do that and whether it really is endorsed by the firm itself. Staff assistance programs funded in many throughout the United States by the Legal Services Corporation. The Legal Aid Society in New York has 1,100 full-time lawyers, most of whom are funded by the City of New York and who provide the defense for most of those indigents who are accused of crime in New York. But it does have a major civil component of some 100 lawyers full-time providing legal service. There are similarly funded offices throughout the country that provide full-time professional staff to do that. The issue there is the adequacy of its funding. Certainly those who work in the Legal Service Corporation offices are firm believers of increasing staff plans because they believe that is the most efficient way to go. They're trained, they know the problems, and familiarity with housing court and the like. The Legal Services Corporation has had a checkered career with respect to providing the funds. There has been an attitude to seek to eliminate the Legal Services Corporation. Certainly that was the Reagan administration's committed policy. To the extent it has survived through the funding of Congress, the funding has been relatively reduced from what it was initially 11 years ago. Without the adequacy of funding, there are fewer lawyers to serve those needs. With Congress insisting on the funding, what then has happened is there has been a series of regulations that constrict the opportunity of the various offices to serve as they might have and as they wish to serve, with restricting kinds of activities in which the offices can engage, the sort of cases that they can take, the need to turn in any fees that they collect, and a series of regulations that are pretty discouraging to those of us who seek to run those offices. And finally, I guess another way of getting to the Legal Service Corporation is to put people on the board who basically are hostile to the notion of government providing legal service in the civil nature to poor people. Other devices that have occurred have IOLTA, interest on lawyer trust accounts, and as you know, that is an idea that has spread throughout the country, where lawyers who take funds of clients in nominal amounts or for brief periods of time can pool those in an account, the interest of which can go to this IOLA or IOLTA foundation or agency or fund. It is not taking interest on escrow or trust funds or others where there's more than $100 or $200, but it's on modest amounts for short periods. That has generated many millions of dollars in many jurisdictions that are earmarked basically for legal services. The Washington Legal Foundation suggests that those of us involved in that activity are radical left-wingers, and our activities that we support are despicable. I think that is their latest word. And that's debatable, too, I would suppose. Then there's private funding of the likes of a Legal Aid Society in New York, where we get $1.5 million from the Legal Services Corporation. The private bar donates $6 to $7 million a year to do that. A next effort that we try to bridge that gap, and perhaps the most important, is to simplify the legal system. There are many things that can be done and should be done to make it easier to resolve legal disputes, those that involve the indigent. Many of the matters that now require court appearance should indeed be administrative proceedings, particularly in family issues. The notion that you need to have a lawyer to go to court in order to do some phase of a family dispute or a matrimonial seems to be of a different era. So too in the housing and other areas, we should move it into an administrative arena away from the court. Another is that we need to convince the bar that they should be less adamant and aggressive in going after those who they believe are engaged in unauthorized practice of law, where it is indeed paralegals, legal assistants, or others. Many of the tasks that lawyers do could readily be done by people without a license or degree, and there are many who are prepared to assist in forms or giving guidance to their clients. I don't go the full way of subscribing to the view of Chairman Durand of the Legal Services Corporation of a few years ago, whose solution was to deregulate the profession. Thus, everybody could practice law. If everybody could practice law, then there would be enough around to serve the needs of the poor if they were prepared to help the poor. It seems to me, and some others, that we have reached the point that the gap cannot be closed, short of asking the lawyers themselves to do that. And we know that there are constitutional issues, slavery, the taking without due process, unequal protection, and so forth, but I will not get into that. There are those who say that while you're competent, if you do it on a voluntary basis, once you are required to do it, you lose your competence, or perhaps that if you're hostile, you will not serve the client as well. There's the issue, isn't it unfair to lawyers? This is society's problem. And if you don't ask the plumbers to do free plumbing, why should you ask the lawyers? And there are distinctions, I hope, between lawyers and plumbers that could understand that. But I guess finally, for the moment, there is a code of professional responsibility to which all lawyers are subjected. And it says, every lawyer should render public interest legal service. The basic responsibility of each lawyer engaged in the practice of law is to provide public legal service. The rights and responsibilities of individuals and organizations are increasingly defined in legal terms. As a consequence, legal assistance in coping with the web of statutes, rules, and regulations is imperative for persons of modest and limited means. The basic responsibility for providing legal services for those unable to pay ultimately rests upon the individual lawyer, and so forth. So my view is, if we believe that, then I see no harm in our saying, yes, we shall do it. It bothers me when we say that we have undertaken this oath and we have imposed this regulation upon us, but indeed are not discharging it. Again, the surveys indicate that between 15 and 20% of the bar are actually rendering some service that would qualify in terms of the definition of pro bono. And the thrust is, if you believe that it is principally a responsibility of lawyers, and if we have said to ourselves that we wish to regulate ourselves and we believe that this is the responsibility of all of us to the legal system, we are really the caretakers and stewards of the system of justice, and it really isn't going to work unless everybody has access to it, then if we believe that, I see no hostility to suggesting on some modest basis of 20 hours a year or 25 hours a year that, yes, we will impose that upon us and not only talk about it, but actually perform it. Thank you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about what I view to be an important and timely topic. Let me say at the outset that, as by way of apology to my colleagues in academia who might be in the audience, that I'm not going to be particularly philosophical or jurisprudential in my remarks. I'm going to try to be as practical as I can. I don't think that I can, in 20 minutes, convince people who don't believe in individual freedom or liberty that they ought to. I'm not going to convince people that you can't legislate prosperity in 20 minutes, or that the pioneer spirit of individual responsibility ought to be upheld. Instead, I want to talk about mandatory pro bono, and I want to talk about the fact that I have some practical problems with it. And maybe for another time we can talk about more broader philosophical concerns. There are a couple of aspects of mandatory pro bono, and some, one of which is let's direct mandatory pro bono at providing legal services for the poor. And as Mr. Folger pointed out, there's another aspect of this, which is let's require lawyers more broadly to include representation for charitable organizations, foundations, bar work, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, some of my remarks will apply more to one of these kinds of mandatory pro bono devices than to others, and it will be hard for you to pick one from the other. Let me first begin with the idea that we need mandatory pro bono in order to help the poor. Mr. Folger himself pointed out, and what I think, and I don't think I'm being uncharitable here, as really his sole argument in favor of mandatory pro bono from an instrumentalist perspective, is that it'll help the poor. And let me say that it won't help the poor. Even when it's targeted specifically at the poor, let me begin by making the basic observation that poor people, like middle-class people and rich people, are consumers in the economy and in society. They don't consume as much as richer people, but they consume food, clothing, shelter, et cetera, et cetera. They don't consume legal services in the same proportion as other people. And the reason is because they want to use their limited resources to buy other things. Or put it differently, if we really want to help the poor people, let's give them the money. Let's take the 20 or 25 hours that lawyers will give to help poor people through the provision of mandatory legal services and make both sides better off by simply giving the poor people the cash. They may not buy legal services with the cash, but are we really prepared to say they shouldn't be allowed to make that judgment for themselves? Another reason why mandatory pro bono won't help the poor can be understood at looking at how poor people are going to be consuming the legal services provided by mandatory pro bono attorneys. And let me say that I'm absolutely in agreement with Mr. Forger when he identifies housing and matrimonial work as the two items of legal business that mandatory pro bono lawyers are going to be providing. Mr. Forger suggested in his remarks that we'll have fewer evictions and even fewer homeless people if we have a regime of mandatory pro bono. But let's keep in mind a little basic economics. First of all, from the standpoint of landlords, the provision of mandatory legal services for the poor is going to increase the cost of providing houses for the recipients of pro bono legal services. It's going to, in other words, lead to higher rents so that tenants will not, in fact, be helped by the provision of mandatory legal services. Maybe we should give the poor people money if we're concerned about housing for the poor and allow them to buy more housing, i.e. to compete more directly for housing services with middle class and upper class people. With respect to the other and probably the dominant aspect of mandatory pro bono, divorce and child custody cases, it seems to me that maybe it's a good thing in society to lower the cost of divorce even further. It's not entirely obvious to me that that's the case, but let's assume arguendo that it is. The fact of the matter is that if you lower the cost of divorce, there's going to be more of it. Again, simple supply and demand. And so we're going to have to keep increasing the amount of mandatory pro bono requirement that we impose on lawyers in order to keep up with this ever-increasing demand for the services of attorneys providing domestic legal help for clients, which is, it seems to me anyway, does not fall into the category of urgent social need, but I don't know. So if pro bono really isn't being done to help the poor, why is it being done? And let me suggest two sources. First, it stems from the dominant view in American culture, that there is a notion that we can solve every problem in society by regulation. To quote a July 20 issue of The Economist, to a lot of Americans, it now seems that prosperity can be bought like insurance, and that where social engineering has become out of fashion in Eastern Europe, it's become quite fashionable in the U.S. So there is this idea that, well, just like we can ban begging, we can stop the demand for, stop the problems associated with too little legal services by mandating pro bono. But that's, I don't think, the real reason. Frankly, I think the main reason can best be seen by doing the following thought experiment. Is it coincidence that this push for mandatory pro bono, particularly by lawyers from big Wall Street firms like Milbank Tweed, is coming at a time when the consumer demand for the services of those firms is at the moment outstripping the available supply? We're in a temporary disequilibrium situation, as evidenced by layoffs of partners and associates in large firms. Think about the fact that in the pro bono context, the lawyers bringing pro bono cases often will be bringing them against defendants who must pay to hire lawyers. This demand for lawyers will increase as a consequence of mandatory pro bono, that is, demand for paying lawyers legal services. And it's going to increase disproportionately for law firms that traditionally represent defendants. Similarly, as many have shown, lawyers, the cost of a mandatory pro bono regime are not going to fall randomly across the legal profession. Rather, the costs are going to be disproportionately borne by solo practitioners and lawyers who practice in small firms for a variety of reasons. They're less able to handle their paying clients when they are faced with a pro bono challenge. If you're an only lawyer and you're in court on a pro bono matter, that's going to be much more difficult than if you're in a big firm to juggle your cases. Similarly, these firms have a smaller base with respect to profits and therefore less able to amortize the cost of pro bono work across the firm as a whole. Also, most pro bono plans, including the one being discussed in New York, allows lawyers to buy their way out, which is at a flat fee. That is, the lawyer making very little money in a solo or small practice has to pay the same amount to buy her way out as a lawyer at Milbank Tweed, which is an extremely regressive mechanism for discharging this social obligation. It wasn't popular during the Civil War, and I'm not sure it's going to be popular among solo practitioners and pro bono practitioners now. Where the pro bono requirement can be fulfilled by doing reduced rate work for free work for foundations and other organizations, pro bono work also benefits the big firms by allowing them to have loss leaders to attract these paying clients and other matters, and also as vehicles for training associates by having them do pro bono work to discharge the partner's obligations, or having them do these other works, and having and allowing associates to cut their teeth on these matters is a luxury not available to sole practitioners or to lawyers who practice in small firms. Mr. Forger mentions this argument that, well, you know, we have imposed the pro bono obligation on ourselves because we are a profession. Let me make a couple of observations about that point. First, I don't recall when I was in law school, taking the bar, reading the rules associated with law practice, that I was going to be compelled to do pro bono work in any certain amount, or at least work that I myself did not, in my own conscience, define as pro bono work. But second, and more importantly, saying that there is a mandatory pro bono requirement is really should be translated as follows. It should be translated as saying the legal profession is a regulated industry. It's a cartel. You're able to attract, as a lawyer in this cartel, super competitive profits as a consequence of having a license to practice law. In order to for society to obtain back some of this deadweight social loss, we are going to require that you do a little mandatory pro bono. My answer to that, it seems to me there's an incredibly simple answer to that, which is if the legal profession is a cartel, and if it's sucking up this deadweight social loss, let's do what we do with other monopolies, other cartels. Let's break it up. Rather than have still more unnecessary regulation on the legal profession. Let me just conclude by making a couple of other, again, embarrassingly practical points, but I think they're worth making. For one thing, in any substantial jurisdiction, having a mandatory pro bono requirement is going to necessitate a substantial bureaucracy just to process what is associated with pro bono and what isn't. But far more importantly than that, somebody is going to have to make the decision, what is pro bono? In other words, for me, as a corporate lawyer who represents clients who are trying to take small companies public in my spare time when I'm not being pedagogic or doing scholarship, or someone who represents clients in front of regulatory agencies, I'm embarrassed to admit I'm paid for this consulting work. But I'm not embarrassed to tell you that I think it's pro bono. I think that lawyers who do transactional work of the kind that I've just described serve a very useful societal function in lowering transactions costs, in having socially beneficial, wealth-enhancing transactions be effectuated. And the idea that there is a central regulatory authority that is set up to say, this work that so-and-so does is pro bono and discharges this lawyer's obligation to the bar is great. But the rest of the work you folks do for money, that's pro malum. I find incredibly distasteful, just speaking for myself. So the idea that we're going to have this central authority to decide what is and what isn't pro bono, the idea that it really, in my view, degrades the practice of law for paying clients, I think are strong, are important concerns that people who think about the mandatory pro bono requirement ought to take into account. Let me just close by making a basic idea that there are lots of complaints right now that there's too much litigation in society. And the idea that we're going to fund or require lawyers to subsidize litigation that the market system wouldn't produce otherwise is not going to benefit poor people. And it's certainly not going to benefit the reputation of the legal profession. And I will close by making the following point that applies very much to mandatory pro bono work, but it also applies to things like a lot of environmental laws, such as CERCLA, the Superfund laws, or a lot of the securities laws, a lot of OSHA, a lot of the modern regulatory state. People one day are going to wake up, that is non-lawyers, and look around and think to themselves, who is benefiting by this? Have we really bought a lot of environmental quality with these environmental regulations? Have we bought a lot of protection for investors with these securities regulations, or protection for employees in the workplace with these workplace regulations, or protection for the poor with this mandatory pro bono requirement? Or are we simply pushing the demand curve for lawyers further and further and further out to the right, and creating the groundwork for far more pernicious regulation of the legal profession than anybody, including the proponents of mandatory pro bono, really want. Thank you.
Let's hear again from Mr. Forney for a few minutes before we take questions from the audience.
Well, the reality is that there are a lot of poor people in this country, and the reality is in New York City, for example, there are over 2 million below the poverty level, many of whom have real life and death problems that need attention and the intervention of somebody who has the legal skill. It is fine to talk of troubles of definition and administrative bureaucracies, and certainly there are 100 reasons why this isn't a pure delight. There are lots of reasons that the people are poor and maybe they should get out of their problems in other ways. But you see, this is not mandatory legal services for poor people. It is seeking to provide some legal service for people who cannot afford a lawyer. And there are people like that. And it isn't necessarily major litigation that they're engaged in. A number of us in the city deal with AIDS patients. One can say, well, they brought it on themselves, whatever the cause of that may be. I take life as it is, and I'm not getting into moral judgments. But there are people in the later stages of life who are in poverty, who need help, and need help from lawyers. Maybe they can get it from the academicians, maybe they can get it from legal services offices, but they need access. They need things as basic as health proxies. They have a right to have some counseling and some support. Even in the matrimonial, you know, one can ridicule on lowering the cost of divorce, but why should issues depend upon your ability? Access to justice depend upon your financial means. I don't know why people without resources shouldn't have some of the rights that everybody else has. And this really is not a big plot of the major firms. Professor Macy is not familiar with the plan that is proposed in New York, and he mistakes the plan, although it is a humorous note to talk about the Civil War. But this plan was evolved with a group of solo small practitioners as well as large firms trying to provide a plan that would not make it disproportionate to any group in particular. And indeed, out of deference and the request of the solo practitioners, the notion of having a, quote, buyout was introduced. And we expressly stated that if you have fewer than or more than 10 lawyers, it is not applicable. So, Professor Macy, I can't do the Civil War bit and buy out in my firm and foist it on the solo practitioner. That just simply is not so. As to a bureaucracy, at least in the plan we proposed, all that a lawyer had to do annually when he certified and paid his dues or registration was to state that he had complied with this. That's the bureaucracy. What is the scope and definition? It's whatever the bar chooses to call it, or the state organization that regulates the bar. At the moment, I think it is sufficient to say there are poor people. They may prefer to have money, but who's giving it to them? And until that day comes, Professor Macy, I suppose that maybe they're better off if we offer no legal service and wait for others to provide them with the means that they would rather have. But indeed, in New York, in that very case in point, we brought a proceeding against the city of New York with respect to the adequacy of the housing allowance for people on poverty. And the Court of Appeals required them to provide an increased level as being constitutionally mandated with their obligation to provide housing. Simply increasing that level of support enabled thousands, literally thousands, to stay in their apartment. I don't know, sure, that increased the cost because the government is now giving more money to landlords, but the cost in expensive hotels, which is absurd, and terrible living conditions can be avoided. So I think the bureaucracy is not a problem, and I think that the disproportionate burden on smaller solo practitioners. All I'm seeking to do, and you can devise your own plan if you would subscribe to it, which you do not, is that we lawyers who have the key to the system of justice ought to do something with our time. We all have time that we can devote to helping those that just don't have that access. And if there are other ways of easing their plight, and if you can do it without the intervention of law, but that's the only objective that I have.
We'll take questions from those of you who will.
You really answered your own argument, which is I understood you to say that if the legal profession was a cartel with barriers to entry, then this tax on the profession would be justified. And in point of fact, the legal profession is a cartel. And as a practical matter, which is the way you stated your argument, it is not going to be broken up. So you've provided the basis for Mr. Forger's request for this. Also, I did get a sense in listening to your remarks that, in a sense, your argument proves too much. I mean, everything, if mandatory pro bono is terrible, then voluntary pro bono suffers from the same problem. In effect, providing any services to the poor, it doesn't help them. We should give them money. It's all a terrible, bad thing. It's subsidizing litigation. So perhaps you'd like to give us a few moments here about how none of us should ever volunteer to help the poor, and providing legal services
right
for the poor is a bad idea.
Let me take your first question first and your second question second. On the first question, Let's assume, as I think you're quite right, that it's unlikely that the legal professions cartel is going to be broken up anytime soon. If we want to deal with the problem of these super competitive rents that the legal profession has gotten, you have to first identify them. That is to say, people who are now in the legal profession. Let me back up and just say, all of the monopoly profits, if you will, have been competed away by now. So that to the extent that we're going to be punishing people, it's going to be the people who had advantage of the cartel before new entry competed away all the gains. So it would be people of Mr. Forger's generation, not mine. And second of all, even if you assume that there are people in the profession still making monopoly returns, which is, I think, counterfactual and certainly counterintuitive, does it make sense to solve this problem through mandatory pro bono? Do you want to have a $400 an hour attorney fiddling around with a $80 or $300 divorce matter? Wouldn't it make more sense just to say, turn over the money and give it to the poor person? The poor person is likely to be far happier with the $20,000 in fees that the partner at the big firm is foregoing than the $800 worth of legal services, because the poor person can go buy the $800 worth of legal services from a small specialist practitioner and have the rest of the money to consume. Both parties are better off. Oh, actually, all three. The smaller lawyer who's getting the $800 business, the big lawyer who has more free time, and the poor person who has more disposable income and the legal services. So the reason I don't think my argument collapses on itself is because, in fact, there are better ways of running the railroad. You had a second question?
Can I? I will buy that argument. I agree totally with him. And if we could get the lawyers to give money instead of time, that would be a much more efficient way. And therefore, I would certainly endorse a plan that would say every lawyer would give $1,000 a year or $2,000 a year or $500 a year.
Of course, the problem
is legal services. That's fine. You've won that point. I'm with you.
Great. The problem, of course, is that once we identify the legal profession as a cartel, and the reason it's a cartel is because of licensing, we've then got to go after hairdressers. I once asked my barber, who was studying for the hairdressing test, what was going to be on this her exam. She said, well, they asked questions like, name all the bones in the human face, and tell how many miles the Earth is away from the sun, questions that are about as relevant to her ability to cut my hair as some of the questions on the bar exam. I think. We can't really limit this to the legal profession. But
don't forget you need the hairdresser's code of responsibility to go with it. I'm done.
Let's hear from the other microphone.
Mr. Forger, my name is Fred Ansell. I'm from Washington. Since you're the more unpopular speaker, I'm going to pick on you. Your goal seems to be to provide every poor person in New York who needs legal services. And I would like to draw the parallel. We've been picking on California all day. Let's pick on New York. New York Times had a very interesting front page article about 10 days ago, which I hope you saw. It was about New York City's commitment to provide shelter to every homeless person in New York City. And the result was that people who were living together with relatives moved out of their homes with relatives, said, I'm homeless. Went to the city, able-bodied people went to the city, people who had worked, moved into places where the New York City taxpayers are spending $2,400 a month to house able-bodied, formerly working people at taxpayer expense. What happened was you provide free homes for people, and suddenly you have a lot more homeless people. And I would draw the parallel that if you provide free legal services to everyone who needs legal services, you will never satiate the need for legal services. Poor people will bring claims, will suddenly have a need that they never knew they had before. And you'll never solve the problem. You'll continue to grow. And I'd be interested in your reaction to that.
My response is, I could not conceivably devise a system that would give legal service to the needs of the poor people in the city of New York. They're just isn't that amount of time, and there isn't that amount of money that could take care of that. So that's an ideal situation that could not exist. With respect to whether providing some legal help to people with real legal problems should be scrapped because there is a system in New York that seemingly encourages two families that are bottled up in a two-bedroom apartment to move out, I don't think that's, whether that is a good policy or a bad policy, I don't think that's a good argument for saying lawyers should not assist poor people. You've set priorities, at least in New York, because we can't possibly handle but maybe 12 or 13%. And so you do the most critical issues first, and issues like that probably would never get any legal service in any event. You're more likely to go after the needing the check or the heat in the apartment or the AIDS issue, something that is far more life-threatening.
On the
side. For the two panel members, I'm rather concerned of Mr. Forger's very quick glossing over of how the bar is going to determine what pro bono is and what's going to qualify. Very often, these pro bono plans include the criminal defense of indigent persons accused of crimes. Now, how is it in the public service for the most notable pro bono representation in my mind is Wilmer Cutler and Pickering spending the equivalent of $1 million to keep Ted Bundy out of the electric chair, given pro bono? What is the public good that would come from programs that serve to stave off that sort of justice?
Well, I guess there, if one had a mandatory program, the mandated aspect of it is that everybody should donate some hours in issues. In my case, if it's helping poor people, such issues as they may choose to engage in. They can either instruct people as to the process, they can work to improve and make more efficient the court system, or they can do a variety of issues affecting the legal concerns and civil matters. We don't have a civil Gideon, therefore, rarely is this involved in dealing with crime. There is no right to counsel at some point on an appeal in a death penalty case, and there are some lawyers who believe that that is a very important legal issue that they should pursue. Some don't believe that death is a proper answer, no matter what the crime. A lot disagree with that, but I would not condemn a whole program because somewhere along the line it wouldn't be funded probably on the mandated program. Someone chooses to take on an appeal of a death penalty case.
Gary Lawson, Northwestern Law School. A one-sentence question to each panelist. John Macy, you skipped the second of the two questions you originally asked. I will re-ask it. Is the logical implication of your position that voluntary pro bono legal services for the poor is a bad idea?
Right.
And for Mr. Forger, I would like to hear why you believe that lawyering is categorically different from hairdressing and plumbing. Or would you apply your same analysis to hairdressers, plumbers, carpenters, and grocers?
Gary, my answer, the reason I think voluntary pro bono is fine is for two reasons. First, voluntary pro bono provision of legal services is priced. That is to say, when I give my time to help an indigent client or a pro bono case, I'm making an actual sacrifice of both my time and income. And to that extent, there is going to be an efficient level of provision of those services in the sense that I'm not going to devote time to trivial issues to discharge this responsibility. I'm going to make some judgments about which of these things are worth bringing and not. So it's an entirely different matter. Similarly, on the purely moral matter, I was interested to note that I'm not the first person to have taken the side that I'm taking on the issue of pro bono. Actually, perhaps the first person was St. Thomas Aquinas, who in the Summa Theologica was dealt directly with the issue as an advocate bound to defend the suits of the poor. And St. Thomas Aquinas is coming into some notoriety in the recent Clarence Thomas hearings, of course, since he's the person who perhaps gave natural law a good name. It seems to me that his answer to this issue is quite right, which is that there are contexts in which lawyers will be obliged to defend the suits of the poor, but that no advocate is bound to do so. It's an extremely personal matter, and the moral obligation arises in a circumstantial context, that is, out of the relationship of the individual provider of the services in the context of the person who needs the services, and that there really is an unbounded aspect to mandatory pro bono in the sense that, as the question asked just before yours pointed out, there's always going to be poor. There are always going to be people in need of legal services, more poor and more in need in the current regulatory context than there otherwise be, in my view, but there will always be them. And as a consequence, the natural outgrowth of a mandatory pro bono system, it seems to me, is that the moral obligation extends until there are no more poor people, until every lawyer is spending all of his or her time on these issues, which doesn't seem to me to be a natural, a useful stopping point. So my answer to your question is yes, voluntary pro bono is fine.
I guess there is. I find a distinction between the hairdresser and the lawyer, and I won't go into the fact as to whether one is a learned profession or not, but doing it on a pro bono basis or without legal representation, where is the greater risk in not having your hair cut or your hair washed versus facing a life and death situation where a lawyer's help is required? And I think that it is quite different for those of us that say that the rule of law pertains in our land and that we have a stake in the justice system. Maybe we also have a similar stake in hairdressing, but most of us here don't. And I think there is a difference in terms of our responsibility as lawyers, as well as the well-being of the community, to have a rule of law and access to justice of all people. If some don't have access to the hairdresser, that's one of the breaks in life, and maybe we can figure out a way of doing that one day, but I think that doesn't measure high on the agenda.
We're running very short of time. Let's try to make provision for two questions anyway, if we keep them brief.
My name is Eric Jaffe. This question is for Mr. Forger. Mostly it's an allocation question. I'm curious as to why the fact that I choose the profession of law, for whatever reasons I happen to choose that, suddenly requires me to expend my excess time and my excess resources providing legal services. You say that legal services are more important than haircuts, but it seems to me that food, arguably, is more important than legal services. And if I would choose to spend my 10 or 20 hours per year of excess time in a soup kitchen providing food and giving food, why is it that the legal profession suddenly deigns to tell me what I must spend my excess time on in the form of providing matrimonial assistance?
Well, you opted for a career in law, and it has a tradition, and it has an obligation. And I think that when you come into this system of justice, you have certain obligations to it. I think all of us who've spent a lot of time in it believe that we ought to make it better, more efficient, and more accessible. And if we all did that, whether it's out of divine inspiration or moral spirituality, that would be fine. The only reason I advocate causing, and probably you and lots of other people are doing this and more, but it is disproportionate burden. There are a lot of folks that really aren't doing that.
Well, that doesn't go to the question of net social gain. If I could do more good by spending all of my excess time otherwise, why not do that for the benefit of all society?
Well, it's simply that what you would be doing otherwise, a lot of folks without the legal talent could do. You have a legal talent, and we just soon have you use that legal talent if we have, so long as we're quoting folks, I can quote Learned Hand, but thou shalt not ration justice. And that's our obligation as lawyers.
This might be the last question coming up.
My name is Keith Cavett. I'm with the Criminal Defense Division of the Legal Aid Society in Manhattan. Professor Macy, I want to know why it wouldn't be better to make the argument from principle instead of making the practical argument that mandatory pro bono won't work. Why wouldn't it be better to make a principled argument that this mandatory pro bono proposal is odious and against natural law? And if Mr. Forger were to address satisfactorily your procedural and practical concerns, would you then concede that it would be okay to proceed? Mr. Forger, would you please explain to me why someone's need places a claim upon my services, my life, my time, and my energy that I do not recognize? And isn't it true that there is no legal, social, moral, or any other impediment to those who wish to address that need to supply it themselves voluntarily?
Thanks. For the perspective of my future career on the bench, I can't make these broad. No. Actually, the reason that I made the practical argument instead of the broad argument is that, in my own view, the broader philosophical or jurisprudential or natural law conclusions derive from the practical concerns. The reason that mandatory pro bono, in my view, is odious is because and unethical is because we can make every party to the arrangement, the lawyers and the poor and society as a whole, better off with an alternative scheme. Therefore, given the fact that we could make everybody who's interested in the arrangement better off, continue to press for a mandatory pro bono system in the face of logic, it seems to me has got to have some kind of, you know, it's got to be one has to view that with suspicion. So, you know, my kind of big picture conclusions, either jurisprudentially or philosophically or what have you, flow immediately from my more narrow practical concerns, and I don't think there are. You said if all of these practical concerns could be answered, I'm quite confident that because of this relationship between the practical concerns and the moral concerns, they're unanswerable.
Mr. Forger. Well, I would just comment there that while we're waiting for utopia, we might as well take care of some of the needs of the poor that require legal assistance. And if we can eliminate all of that through all these other means of provision for their problems, that would be better. As to the, first of all, I would say to the speaker who is doing criminal defense work for indigent people, that is a remarkable endeavor and commitment to a area of practice that certainly has my high regard and appreciation. There has been frequently in these debates the question as to whether people who are already serving in that capacity should be asked to do more. And one could say, and I know that wasn't a personal issue that was raised, that there are varying suggestions when people discuss this to exempt those government service or those who are already providing service for poor people, even with a level of compensation, very inadequate as it is. But I guess my response is that if I believe the Code of Professional Responsibility that applies to me, it says I should do this. And maybe I don't want to, but at least that's what the code says, and that is what I have devoted my life to as a lawyer, and you out here, presumably, if we believe that, those are the rules. The only thing that this doesn't say, although it says should and ought, and this is the principal responsibility, it doesn't say, and you've got to do more than say, yes, we ought to and we should. It says, you will.
I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last word. We're going to have some important announcements from our hosts and the society in just a moment. Please join me in thanking our panelists.